Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz, episode 45 for October 17th, 2008, KDE. This show is brought to you by listeners like you and your contributions. We couldn't do it without you. Thanks so much. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show that covers free, libre, open source software with Randall Schwartz of Stonehenge.com, pro programmer extraordinaire, squeak programmer, the king of squeak now. Oh, you're probably not the king. Who's the king of squeak?
Oh, I'm probably the jester.
You're the jester wherever you go.
Well, it's funny because I'm on the Squeak board, and we haven't really elected like a leader, and I end up like driving everything. So,
I think maybe that's true in many open source projects, or any volunteer project. It's the person who's willing to step forward and say, "Let's go," and everybody kind of welcomes that kind of input, I think, because
I sort of fell into that one in the Perl community too. You know, there was Larry Wall did a great job creating something really cool in the P5P, the Perl 5 porters, the guys that, you know, kept it and maintained it, managed it and stuff. But, you know, it takes somebody that has, I'm motivated because, you know, the more people that know what's happening with the Perl and now with the Smalltalk world, you know, the more money I make, the more I can put bread on the table.
That's probably true of a lot of people. I think I've seen this with Floss. You've revitalized the show by your willingness to take the bull by the horns, set down, do some work, and get the thing going. And you've done a great job. I'm really excited. Who's on the show this week?
We have a wonderful guest this week. I have known this guy for a few years. We've met up in many countries around the world. He's a great speaker. He talks about KDE, the K desktop environment. His name is Aaron Sego, and I believe he's talking to us from somewhere in Canada.
Oh, this is good. I KDE, everybody who uses Linux is familiar with. Mm-hmm. We're going to find out a little bit more about it. Where are you calling from, Aaron?
Calgary, which is just east of the Rocky Mountains.
I know where it is. That's where the Stampede is.
That's right. Every year, a whole bunch of people dressed up in cowboy hats and boots come out and pretend to be cowboys with us. So
big hat, no cattle.
That's right. Lots of beer.
And you're on the plains, so winter is a little hard.
Yeah, it gets harder if you go further east, but it's hard enough for me as it is. I don't know. Those minus 20 and below days are things I could do without. But it's sunny today. It's actually fairly nice out today. So I'm just going to be in denial that winter's coming for hopefully a few more weeks.
I have a theory that a harsh winter is good for open source programmers. It keeps them inside and focused.
That's right. It kills the bugs and increases the code count, right?
Exactly. The lines. Yeah. When did Linus write Linux? Probably in the worst Finnish winter of all, right? You know, just because the snow goes up, code count goes up with the snow.
I was going to say there's a difference between the weather, the winters.
kills the bugs and replaces them with features.
Yes. Oh, wouldn't that be nice? So what is your role at KDE, Aaron?
Well, I've got two kind of hats that I wear in the project. One is a technical hat within which I write code like a lot of the people in the project. I'm the lead developer on Plasma, which is our desktop shell, the panels and icons and desktop backgrounds, that part of it. I also work on the foundational libraries, and you'll find I have bits of code tucked away here and there in a lot of the applications.
Is Plasma a window manager, or is it something else?
No. Well, we actually do have a window manager that does 3D OpenGL accelerated, throwing a couple more buzzwords there, window management. It's called Qwin, and it interacts with Plasma very well, but they are separate components. And what Plasma provides is it provides the actual desktop shell. When you first log in, you see traditionally you see icons on your desktop and a panel and or a dock or what have you.
Right.
So that part is that was actually the first application of Plasma. So that's one of the hats I wear in the project, is the technical hat. And I also wear more of a kind of a community slash managerial hat. I sit on the board of directors for our global nonprofit, KDEV, which represents the project for financial and legal purposes. And I also go about and do shows like this with people like you.
You're an evangelist as well.
That's right. Yeah.
So I guess anybody who has used Linux ever, particularly Ubuntu, Kubuntu, I should say, has used KDE. But maybe we should describe for those who haven't what it is exactly.
That's a really good question. What is KDE? When KDE first started 12 years ago, we actually just turned 12 this week.
Happy birthday. This is good timing, Randall. Wow.
Yes, exactly.
It's almost like we planned it. When it started 12 years ago, the goal was to create a coherent, nice desktop with all the basic applications that you'd want for Linux. The fellow who started it, who was at the time in university in Germany, tried to set up a desktop for his girlfriend and failed miserably on Linux, that is. And he looked at what they had on Windows and what they had on Mac, and he just shook his head and went, "This is ridiculous. We should be able to do the same thing," which is, in retrospect, you know, it's one of those classically, you know, insane things to say. Let's just make a whole desktop.
No big deal.
That's right. Yeah. We'll throw a few pieces of code together and voila.
Yeah. I can do it in a couple of days. Should be easy. Trivial.
Exactly. Yeah. Me and my friends.
Yeah. No problem.
So, he put out the traditional Usenet, posting, "Hey, I'm starting a small little project. Let's see where it goes." But that was 12 years ago. Today, the project has really grown and morphed. We do still have a desktop environment, of which Plasma and Qwen, the two things we talked about briefly earlier, are a part of. So you can actually log into a KDE workspace. But we're also an application development framework. So we've got a large series of set of tools that you can actually build applications with, either in C++, Python, Ruby, JavaScript, etc. I believe we even have Perl bindings, Randall.
Perl, yeah.
These days, so it's all good. We also have a number of application suites. So we have a PIM suite or a groupware suite that does, the traditional mail calendaring. We have a set of multimedia applications, such as the very popular Amarok. We've got a fledgling Office suite that's up and coming with its second version, KOffice 2. We've got some image creation utilities such as Digicam, which is a great program for managing your digital photos, etc. Within the core project itself, we actually have a few hundred applications that we offer in sets of suites. And all of those applications, as of now, as of KDE4, which we released the 4.0, the first public release in January, run not only on Linux and in a KDE workspace, but you can run them in any X environment. So if you log into GNOME, for instance, or XFCE or Fluxbox or whatever, shakes your tail, you can actually run applications like Amarok for your media or Krita for your natural brush painting or what have you. What's really cool as well is I heard you talking a little bit earlier in the pre-show about your MacBook.
Yeah.
Do you have?
A potential MacBook. Yeah, I have a MacBook.
Potential MacBook. Okay. Yeah. We also run on Mac OS and Windows.
Oh, really?
Natively. So these are new projects for us. With the 4.1 release that just came out in summer, we basically released a technology preview. They do work, but there are some rough edges here and there. We're hoping with the 4.2 release, they'll be a lot more polished.
Wait, Randall, now we have about 8,000 things to talk about from just what you just said, Aaron.
Thank you.
So let me be a little chronological and go back in time, and then I want to ask you about all these things because it's all very interesting. Yeah. And I do notice on the KDE site, it doesn't say Linux particularly. It says Unix and even Mac and Windows. So that's kind of neat. But originally it was a Linux desktop, I guess. Based on Qt, is that right?
That's right, or as we call it, Qt.
I didn't know it was called Qt. Right.
Yeah, inside of Trolltech, which is actually now part of Nokia. It was originally called Qt, and of course, no one outside of those offices knew that, so everyone called it Qt. So
that's what I always called it. And early on, it was kind of encumbered. The licenses were kind of odd, and I think one of the reasons kind of GNOME emerged as a desktop was in response to that, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, originally Qt was, it was always source included, but it wasn't actually open source or free software.
Right.
So, and the idea was that, you know, if they could let people see the source code, they could both see the quality of it as well as kind of do a try before you buy kind of thing.
But they didn't license it in an open source license.
No, not originally.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was originally under a license called the QPL. Eventually, they released it under an OSI approved, the Open Source Initiative approved license. It's a group that goes around and puts a official blessing, if you will, on licenses. It says, yeah, this is open source. They released under the QPL version 2. Of course, if you've been following open source licensing, you know that one of the banes of our history has been the proliferation of licenses. So you have this license and that license and the other license. And when you look at all these different licenses, you know, your head starts to swim and your lawyers start to rub their hands because they can just feel the bills coming on. So several years ago, Trolltech switched from the QPL version 2 to the GPL, which really helped a lot of people because, like, hey, we know this license. We know how it works and what it works with. As of Qt 4, which was released a couple years ago and which KDE 4 is based on, it's GPL on Windows, Mac, and Linux now. So across all the platforms, it is GPL. And what's cool as well is that it comes with an exception to the GPL. Basically, as long as you're using an open source license, you can link to the free software version of Qt.
Oh, that's neat.
So you're not just limited to the GPL itself. And there's a page on the Trolltech website that lists all the exceptions and whatnot. So that's where we're at right now. And as you can see, over time, it's really evolved towards a more and more open and permissive and simpler to understand licensing system.
That's not quite the LGPL then, because the LGPL would let me have private code linked with your libraries.
Right. Right now, if you want to have proprietary code or code that you don't give to the people that you give your binaries to, you can purchase a developer license from Qt Software, which is a division of Nokia now. So that's the current status of things.
And I only mention that because early on, a number of, I think Mandrake and a number of the other Linuxes that I used GNOME because of this issue. And I think it kind of hung on in my head that, KDE is not quite as open as GNOME, but that's no longer true in any form or fashion. And then the other thing I discovered, which you've already alluded to, is that even if I'm running GNOME, I can run KDE applications.
Right. So there's that kind of divide that has really lingered because of the history of how the entire Linux desktop kind of organically evolved and grew.
Right.
That, you know, you have your GNOME world and you have your KDE world and you have your your very vertical worlds as far as what you're running. You wouldn't run a non-XFCE app if you're running XFCE, right?
Right.
And that's just not true today, like you said. It's a world where you can mix and match. And I'm really quite excited as well about being able to reach out to the people on the Mac and Windows platforms.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So that means I could run any KDE application. Like I could run Amarok native as a native, it's as if it were an OS X app.
That's right. They actually have binaries you can download for Amarok.
Do I need to install anything else? Is there like a KDE library that needs to be living there? Or
yep, and it comes the installers that they provide. There's a KDE on Mac project page, and they've got links to the installers. Part of it, I believe, is built on the Fink packaging system.
Right.
So they just roll out in one nice, glop as far as users concerned, the applications. And right now they're actually working on, and this isn't released yet, I just saw some of the early work the other week. They're actually working on a point and click installer as well. So you can do the old, download the image and then go clickety click click and it's done.
How about Windows users? Same kind of thing?
There's also an installer for Windows, exactly, and it installs all the libraries and whatnot. So it's interesting with Windows and Mac, you'll actually download a few dozen megabytes worth of libraries with the first KDE application that you install. To a Linux or Unix user, that might seem like a whole heck of a lot of software, and I have to kind of throw my mind back to when I used Windows way back in the day and remembering when, a CD full of software was, and then they moved to DVD.
Yeah.
So it may seem a little bit weird for me to go, watch out, it's going to be a few dozen megabytes.
Whoa.
But exactly. Yeah. But what's really cool is once you have that down, adding new applications, most of them are anywhere from a few hundred K to a few megabytes in size. And these provide you with just immense amounts of features and functionalities. So it's a really interesting kind of foundation that you install with the first application, and you can just mix and match from there with what you want to where you want to go from there.
That's really
so how does Qt? So Qt is like a library layer, and then you have a bunch of like application friendly packages that sit on top of that, and then your application sits on top of all that.
Right. So we've got Qt itself, or Qt, and it's a library. And we also provide a set of KDE libraries. So recently with Qt, they started bundling in both WebKit and Phonon. WebKit you probably know from Apple's Safari or the iPhone.
At this point, WebKit might be the best known part of KDE.
It probably is. Yeah, because it actually came out of the KDE project. It started with KDE 2.0.
It was the K browser, right?
Yeah, there was. It was part of Conqueror originally.
Conqueror, that's
and,
right. Yeah,
right. And the actual component itself was called KHTML.
Right.
We delivered it as a component, so we could reuse it in our mail readers, in our help systems, et cetera, et cetera. It was a pervasive component we used throughout KDE2, and it was just a light, nimble, easy to work with web toolkit. So when Apple went shopping, they picked it up. Unfortunately, in the early days, they forked it, but that's kind of come back around. So we ship WebKit with Qt. We also ship Phonon, which is a multimedia framework. So you can write to one API, and your multimedia works regardless of whether you're on, again, Windows, Mac, or Linux.
And it works as if it's a native application.
It works, yes, as a native application.
That's really nice.
And this is really nice for people on the Unix platforms and the Linux platforms, which have a tradition of, you know, to put it kindly, the multimedia layers on those platforms aren't exactly set in stone yet.
Yeah.
They tend to change every few years, and this has been kind of the way it's been for a while. And while we have some extremely competent multimedia frameworks on Linux, BSD, and Solaris these days, they also tend to be very difficult to approach as an average application developer. So Phonon kind of takes the smooths that out, gives you a very approachable API that looks like you're using any other part of Qt or the KDE libraries. And so Phonon actually came out of KDE as well. So there's this kind of galaxy and this back and forth between Qt's libraries and KDE's libraries to provide a very complete set of tools for application developers. And then on top of that set of libraries, the applications are written. So some applications may use Phonon and the hardware awareness library Solid, for instance. Another one might use just Qt 4 and Phonon or whatnot. So which libraries you use kind of varies, but we package libraries up together so that applications can choose what to use. And the end result is you get applications that are really easy to write because you don't have to worry about re-implementing the things that everyone else has already implemented because we try and push that into libraries.
WebKit is a very good example. I mean, WebKit is all three platforms. I mean, I run it on Mac, I run it on Windows, I run it on Linux. It's updated all the time. It's really fast. And it's side-by-side development. I presume it's one stream that they're developing all the time.
Yeah, and what's really neat about sharing technologies like that is you have these unintended but really cool side effects, such as in the Plasma desktop, when you log into Plasma, the KDE workspace, you can actually run Mac OS X dashboard widgets on Plasma. And the reason for that is because, of course, they built their dashboard. It's JavaScript on top of WebKit.
Yeah.
So there's some WebKit-specific stuff in there, but that's okay because we use that too. So
that is really cool.
It creates this big ecosystem, right?
Yeah.
We can all kind of share and swap, and it's just, it continues to grow. I mentioned the OS X widgets. We also support Google Gadgets now in the Plasma workspace.
Also JavaScript, CSS, WebKit.
Yeah.
Yep.
Python, and ECMAScript, straight ECMAScript. So.
I see in the future a day when all operating systems will separate and their differences will disappear. And you'll just write one application and it'll run on all of them.
No. I don't think so.
No. I pray for that day. But when that happens, you've got critical mass. And suddenly, I mean, that's what's so cool about web apps, I guess, really. And that's why WebKit is such an important part, really, of what you're doing.
Yeah, and I think there's some really interesting lessons to be learned from what's happened with web apps. I mean, from my perspective, I look at web apps and I see people. I remember when Gmail came out and people were raving because you could drag and drop emails.
Right.
And I had to scratch my head and go, I'm pretty sure I had that on my Mac in 1984, but okay, good job. The fact that we get really excited about really basic features in web apps should be kind of a signal to us, right? That says we're excited but it's not because of the UI, right? The UI is fairly limited. What's neat about it is that they're trying new visual metaphors, for one. So they're breaking out of the, you know, little boxy widgets, yes, push buttons and whatnot. Yeah. But the other thing is the pervasiveness of it and the ability to create a social or a socially aware system where you can actually carry both your applications and your data with you. And I think, you know, I don't want to peer too deeply into the crystal ball here, because then you can look back on it in 5 years and poke fun at me. But I think that where things are really headed is a convergence between what we traditionally perceive as you know, desktop software, which is locally run, rich client software, and the web and mobile devices, so that over time we're going to see the kind of difference between them just melt away. I think we're starting to see that with the netbooks that are coming out, such as the EPC, yeah, and what have you, where it's starting to blur the lines, right?
Right. It runs Ubuntu, but who cares? You don't even need to know that.
Actually, the EPC runs Zandros.
Oh, really? It's Zandros. That's right. Yeah.
Which actually runs KDE software on it.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, yeah, you'll actually find Amarok on there, having mentioned that a couple of times already. Yeah. So,
oh, I love Amarok. Amarok's amazing.
Yeah.
So, Leah, have you installed Amarok on your
Mac there? I am actually downloading the full K421 download. It's 421 megabytes, but I'm downloading it right now because I want everything. But what's interesting is Amarok uses MySQL as its database backend, and this might be where you get a little bit of a disadvantage by being as open as you are. You know, if I were going to make it native for the Mac, I'd probably use SQLite as opposed to MySQL, that kind of thing.
They actually tried SQLite. And the problem is, and this is a typical problem of modern applications, actually, is people don't keep themselves to a reasonable number of songs.
Too many songs.
That's right. Yes. You have too many songs. Ding, error.
Too many notes, Mr. Mozart.
That's right. Yes, exactly.
SQLite can't handle it. Oh, that's
5,536 songs should be enough for anybody.
Is that the limit on SQLite? Is 65,000?
No. I'm just saying maybe there's some power of two in there somewhere.
I'm sure there is. Interesting. So they needed a much more powerful database.
Right, especially since they don't just display your songs, right? They actually try and deliver what they call, the Amarok team, that is, calls a music experience.
Right.
And in the new version, they've actually added video as well, so you can watch video podcasts and whatnot right alongside your audio. But they try and deliver an experience that draws as much metadata out of the song or the media files themselves, and then correlates it both with online services as well as your local database. So they really put a lot of pressure on that system. And so for them, they had to move up from simpler embedded databases to using embedded. They still use it as an embedded database, but use MySQL.
Well, let's see here. I've downloaded it, and I have now on my desktop KDE Mac base system, KDE support, Mac QT44, Mac KDE 41211, Mac MySQL. So I'm just going to install all of these, and then I'll be set.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant.
Let me ask you on a more less granular here, and sure, kind of a more larger scale. Originally, this was to scratch, you know, this guy's itch. He wanted his girlfriend to have a better desktop. But now it seems like much more of a global vision for what KDE is all about. Why is why is it becoming such a big project? Why desktops and applications? Is there an overarching plan for all of this?
World domination.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I just wanted to give you a chance
out of Linus's book.
Yeah.
But on a more serious note, I mean, I think what it shows is that when you give people the opportunity to create, they do. You know, there's a huge number of people that are just innately creative, and that also have an interest in surprise software. So it wasn't that, you know, we sat down and went, you know what, let's write a, you know, an Amarok and a Digicam and a Krita and a, you know, and a K-Stars and whatnot, and a Plasma and a Conqueror and a HTML. We didn't sit down and say that. Instead, what happened is that as people had needs, they started to fill them. And as other people had needs and people observed that there was a business model, they started to fill it. So, for instance, our groupware right now, Contact, is largely driven through, you know, the business case behind supporting a groupware system that lets you choose your server on Windows, Mac, and on Linux. You have one interface across all your platforms, and you're not locked into any one vendor's database. That's of extreme interest to certain people in the world, governments as well as corporations. So that, you know, so it's a combination of both personal interest, community, Amarok, you know, keep harping on them, very much community. I mean, for them, media and music is kind of a way of life, right? So it was a way for them to interact with other people. Contact is a business, largely these days anyways, is a business model for the companies that work around it. So, you know, when you let people come together, they will come together, if you don't try and hold it back too much. At the same time, I think that we've tried very hard to create a community that is open, supportive, willing to take risks at time, also willing to, look at where we are critically and say, are we happy with where we are? Yes, no. If not, what can we do to change that part? If we are happy about it, how can we preserve that? So as the product's gotten larger and larger, we've really had to spend, or at least some of us anyways, have had to spend more time looking at those kind of big picture questions, as far as, how do we maintain the sustainability of the project? How do we grow it further?
Right.
How do we keep it business friendly without chasing away the community, right? There's a lot of balancing acts that go on within it. But so far it seems to be paying off. We're seeing, more and more really large deployments. I don't know if you've caught the news, but we are essentially 100% of Brazil's public education system now, servicing by the end of this next year, a little over 50 million students.
That's amazing. So, that's really amazing.
Yeah. So we're seeing some really big wins, the French Parliament, City of Munich, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So I got a slogan for you. Everything but the kernel.
Exactly. Yeah.
Basically, that's it, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we do work with a lot of the
unless you have kernel in development. Do you have a kernel in development?
No. In fact, it's kind of interesting. Over time, we've more and more clearly defined ourselves as the presentation layer, right?
Right.
As a user interface part of it.
Right.
So we used to ship a multimedia system with KDE2 and KDE3, because at the time, for our primary target platforms of Linux and as a secondary platform, the BSDs, we didn't have anything to work with, really, that was sane. That's changed. Both we have, good systems on Linux these days and BSD, but we also have Windows and Mac platforms to take care of. So we actually said, we're not really in the business of making multimedia systems. It's not what we're good at. Let's let the people that are experts at that do that, and we'll just write an interface to that, which is what PhoneOn is. So we, over time, we actually have, as we've expanded into more and more of the topics you might want to cover in the user space, the user interface, the presentation layer, we've actually kind of very carefully and strategically allowed people who are probably better at us at certain things that are below that layer in the stack to do their job as well. So it is kernel, but it's also, we let the multimedia people do their thing. We let, people that are working on security and hardware awareness issues and that, we tie into their work as opposed to reinventing the whole wheel. And I think you'll find that's true in a lot of open source projects, these successful ones, is you find, other people's rafts that you can tie yours onto so you become, a super tanker with a lot less effort.
Yeah, you can't do a kernel though, because what would you change into the letter K? It's all got a K.
Kernel.
You have no idea how many times we've gotten the bug reports about K swap D or whatever, and they'll be like, yeah, this KD application's completely gone crazy on my system. We're like, no, that's actually
the one thing we didn't do.
That's right. Someone stole our K.
It seems like you're well positioned though, as we move into this cross-platform web focused world. How tied to the desktop are you? Can you be a web application?
Well, I think the more interesting question is, can we work with web applications?
Right.
So we've done a lot of work in being able to integrate web content directly with our applications. So we can seamlessly blend web content with a traditional client. And by seamlessly, I mean that we can actually take some web content from a web page or locally, place it into our application, and then also put native widgets on it, so that the user can't really tell what's the traditional rich client stuff and which is the web stuff. That's some pretty cool and complicated things we've done, but it's going to pay off in the coming years. The other side of it is, can we travel? because the when it comes to the mobile world, you still need a device of some sort to be able to view the web, right? It doesn't magically appear in our heads yet.
Right.
You know, William Gibson's dreams of being able to plug in directly are still ahead of us. So in the meantime, we still need devices that we can actually, you know, use and access this content in hopefully very powerful ways. And that's the other place that our frameworks really shine. So the Plasma desktop, for instance, while we use it to actually build an entire desktop that you log into with panels and, you know, taskbars and applications launchers and all these other things. It's also used in applications like Amarok 2 used it in its context view, but it also runs with the same code base, just recompiled on very small devices like the Nokia N810 or the Freerunner phone from OpenMoco. So these are very small devices with not a lot of horsepower compared to what, you know, you'd be getting with your PowerBook or your MacBook. But it runs and it runs well. It's not something where, you know, you launch it and then you wait for, you know, 30 seconds for it to update. Right. It's actually usable on these devices. So we're able to write frameworks as well as applications that can actually travel with us as we become more and more mobile over the next couple of years. And that's really important because this gives us an open source platform on which we can both deliver as well as integrate with what does happen on the web and augment it as well.
What's the relationship with Nokia been? Have they been, it sounds like this is something great for Nokia. I mean, you'll be running on S60 phones.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's when Nokia announced that they were going to buy Trolltech, you know, there was some people going, oh, what's going to happen with it? You know, and for full disclosure for your listeners, I happen to, you know, be able to eat, breathe, and pay my electrical bill because of Trolltech and now Nokia. So I'm probably not completely unbiased in it. But, you know, I was, you know, watching to see exactly what Nokia would do in the transitionary time, which we're still in to some extent. And I've been very impressed with how sensitive they are to issues of corporate culture and really looking at Qt and going, well, what can we do with this? What exciting things can we do with it? How can we take it to the next level? And I think that over the next, you know, even the next couple of months, as well as, you know, as far out as the next, you know, 12 months or so, we're going to see some really exciting announcements that are coming out of Nokia, as well as the Qt software division within Nokia. As far as what we're able to do with it. But yeah, for them, it's a natural. You have this toolkit that travels well from devices all the way up to, you know, laptops and traditional desktops and pretty much everywhere in between that has a real focus on the web and services. So
this is really positioned then across from both the iPhone platform and the Android. Then, I mean, is there like three major thrusts now?
Absolutely. And I think that with some of the things we're working on as far as animation frameworks, the service-oriented architectures that we're putting into, say, the Plasma layer as well, will be able to let us not only compete, but I think actually go a few steps further than either of those platforms.
Cool.
So
cool. I love competition. This is great.
Well, now I'm downloading the entire 3 gigabyte, everything in one big package.
So while we chat, you'll just be downloading stuff.
I'm eating bandwidth by the gigabyte. So yeah, I mean, so once you install the libraries, the back end, you can get download. It looks like everything. Amarok, you got KOffice, KDE Utils, KDevelop, which is great. You have a whole development platform. Mm-hmm. You know, you're set here. The KD Graphics is the program you mentioned that you get all the KDE games.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, on the new platforms for us, the Mac and Windows platforms, there are some applications that work that, you know, I'll tell you right now, work better than others. Yeah. The 4.1 release was a technology preview, so don't expect them to be.
I understand. Excellent. I read the disclaimer.
Excellent. We like to, you know, set expectations, but they do work rather well. And it was interesting because at the launch that we did at Google's headquarters in January, part of the keynote presentation at the launch event was us actually showing three applications. We wanted to keep it fairly short, but the same three applications running exactly the same and just as well on Linux, Windows, and Mac.
Now, are you platform specific when it comes to mobile cell phones? I mean, I presume if you can run an S60, you can run on, for instance, on Android.
Absolutely. So as long as you have the Qt libraries available to you, you're good to go.
Has anybody ported Qt to Android?
I'm not aware of people's efforts on Android at the moment. Not saying there isn't anybody, but
I'd love to put this on my G1 when it comes next week.
Well, if it we've got Qt that works, of course, on mobile Linux. So if it runs Linux, you're pretty well good to go. Yeah. There's also a port of Qt to Windows Mobile. We don't have all of the KDE infrastructure there yet.
That's amazing.
And of course, as you know, Nokia is involved in other platforms as well. So I think that the number of platforms will simply, especially in the mobile space, will just continue to grow for Qt. And that's a really powerful thing. You know, you talked about running software once and it running anywhere.
Right. I
don't think that that's actually out of the reach. I think the reason why we haven't achieved it to date was a combination of the youth of the industry, mm-hmm. right? We still had to figure out what we're doing with hardware and software. We were still learning a lot about how you make this stuff.
Right.
The other side of it is that all of the attempts up to this point have been proprietary, by and large. Even the language is probably most synonymous with the, you know, write once, run everywhere, which would be Java. It was only recently freed by Sun. And so, I mean, up until that point, it too was at least to some extent a proprietary platform. And that really, you know, when you put a proprietary platform in front of people, they kind of look at it and go, yeah, I'm not sure I really trust that, you know.
Right.
Will I bet on it? You know, am I aiding someone else's agendas as well as or instead of mine? And these kind of issues start to crop up. But when you give them open platforms, especially in spaces like mobile, people look at it and go, okay, this is something that I can, you know, lower my cost of R&D and get more returns, and it's safe for me to do that. So I think that with mobile Linux, with Qt becoming more and more available and getting people like Nokia behind it, I think we start to really see the possibility of that, you know, kind of holy grail world where you can begin to write things once and they tend to run wherever. And we work the other way too, right? I mean, I mentioned Google Gadgets and Mac OS before. Personally, I have the opinion that if you write code, I should be able to run it. And so we've, you know, worked with the Google Gadgets, actually worked with some people on their team to do that integration work. But with Mac OS, it's just been, you know, kind of a reverse engineering effort. But we can pull in other people's work as well. So we want to become that kind of that one central hub where it all just fits together.
I like it that it's so cross language as well. So it's is it written in C, C++? The Qt libraries are C, right?
C++, actually.
C++, okay.
Yep. And the bulk of KDE, all of our core libraries are also written in C++. But if you're running an application or writing an application, you basically have to pick what kind of language you want. We've got really cool bindings for Qt 4 based things called Jambi, which is a Java layer. We also have Ruby and Python and JavaScript or ECMAScript, however you like to call it. So you get to kind of pick, you know, your poison. We have some people that do Perl Qt as well and Perl KDE. So you're not tied into a single language or a single hardware platform or a single operating system platform, right? It's basically, and it makes sense when you look at it. We were a bunch of application developers that wanted to write apps and didn't want to have to deal with the mess of having someone else tell us how we did it and where we could run it. So
I believe it's also well. I believe also one of the Google Summer of Code projects for Squeak was a KDE interface as well.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. So you can use
Squeak. I'm learning my Squeak, so I think this will be good. I can tie it to Qt. I actually played with Qt when early on, and it's a great library. I mean, I remember, Randall, I was talking last week about how much I collect these little libraries, you know, because I hate writing GUI interfaces, but these libraries make it so easy.
Yeah, that's, you know, we have the motto, you know, code less, create more.
Right.
And
that's fun.
Yeah, it can be. Yeah.
How accurate were the early decisions on the API design of Qt, say Qt version 1 or 2? How much of those have been a hindrance? How many of you had to abandon as you know, deprecated and move on? Or did you sort of take the right direction from the beginning or what?
That would be a great fairy tail story if that happened that way. But no, the Qt 1 API, if you put it next to the Qt 4 API, is very, very different. Mm. You know, the people that, you know, wrote Qt were also learning. I mean, we came up with some of the ideas, like signals and slots first appeared in Qt, which you'll actually see all over the place. In fact, the C++ standards body has referenced Qt as, you know, kind of inspiration for their signals and slots implementation. So there was a lot of, you know, innovation and just kind of how the heck do we do this? And, you know, C++ is not, object-oriented programming in general is not the easiest thing to do when you're actually trying to write frameworks for other people to use.
Right.
So there's a lot of knowledge that had to be created there. The good news is that Qt 4 is a very mature, very consistent, and very easy to use interface that just covers all kinds of things from networking to XML to threading to, you know, XQuery, and we have a Canvas implementation and OpenGL, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's all very consistent, and where we're at right now, we're pretty happy with, because we had a big change in Qt 1 and Qt 2, very big change in API, and we had another just massive change in Qt 3 and Qt 4. Mm-hmm. Looking forward, we said that, you know, we're happy with Qt 4 at least until 2012, and the only reason why we can't say anything beyond 2012 is because we don't forecast further than 5 years in advance. So,
five seems enough. I think that's good.
Yeah. Exactly. So, and we're still, you know, seeing that horizon out in front of us, that we don't see any barriers that we're running into or any those kinds of issues that will prompt, another big API change. And that's really the work of, you know, 15 or so years of development on how do you make a good object-oriented API.
That's all the way out to the end of the Mayan calendar anyway, so you're probably okay.
Really? When's the Mayan calendar?
It's December 21st, 2012, I think.
Wow.
That's the end.
Then what do we do? Yeah.
The world blows
nothing.
Up.
That's right.
Go from the 4th to the 6th.
I just, you know, all those Mayan COBOL programmers that are retired now are going to come back in. It'll be great. It'll be great boon for them. Yeah.
Yeah.
All those Mayan business apps.
I actually heard the squirrels are taking over.
Oh, good. They have a much better calendar.
The reason I asked about the API is, like, I can imagine that the early ones were probably, since X11 was the only platform you were going to run against, is they were very X-like for, you know, describing what the canvas was, describing what fonts were and stuff. I'm just wondering of how isolated you are now in Qt 4 from the fact that sometimes it's X11, sometimes it's native OS 10, sometimes it's Windows. How right. isolated is your program able to be?
So, actually, the original Qt ran both on Windows and Linux. That was actually the original motivation for Qt itself was...
That's why I was interested in it. It was cross-platform. Right. You could write for Windows and Linux. Yeah. Okay.
The two original, the founders of Trolltech, they were writing an application they wanted to run on both Windows and Linux, and they discovered that everyone was writing their own toolkit and doing it poorly. So they said, you know what, forget that. Let's write a toolkit and do it right, and then give that to other people, and then they can write the cross-platform software.
I think that's why I downloaded it, because I didn't want to learn the Windows API.
Yeah.
Right. And so the question is, you know, the US is how insulated are you? If you're writing a, you know, an application that, you know, I'm on the technical side, I write, work with the Plasma stuff that I mentioned earlier, which is, you know, workspace stuff. And we, you know, I do window management, and every once in a while I'm forced to, you know, go down into the X layer, but that's because I'm working on really bizarre and weird and crazy things that no sane person touches. Mm-hmm. But if you're writing just a normal application, there's nothing that you see that's tied to the native API. Mm. So, you know, you downloaded all of that Macintosh code or Mac apps. We run the exact same code base on Linux. We run the exact same code base on Windows. We don't really change the applications. You just write to the APIs that are provided, and you have this very nice consistent API, and the underlying system isn't exposed.
So, like, if you had a need to say store preference data, then you would have very abstract calls for keep this preference data somewhere, and then on OS 10 it would store it in the preferences thing, and Windows would put it in the registry.
Start the registry, and yes, exactly.
Wow.
So, yeah, and that covers, like I said, just pretty much everything that you can, you know, really hope for these days, from, you know, graphics to multimedia to XML processing to network processes and access to, the mundane things like settings and being able to, you know, say, you know, this window shouldn't have a window border on it. You can do that all in a, you know, platform neutral way. You don't have to occasionally dip below the surface and start writing to the platform unless you're doing something, you know, highly specialized.
Okay, cool.
Now, I just want to make a point. Copper Can in our chat room said, well, if you're going to call QT cute, you really should call KDE kitty.
You know, I would like to argue with that, but I can't. He's got a point.
I don't think, frankly, especially for the enterprise side, kitty is really the way to call go. I kind of like K, you know, X, K. Yeah. It's something like I like about the K thing.
Yeah, it's kind of like an X kind of bent on its side and a little more upright, maybe.
Yeah, it's special K.
A little pole to the left.
So how has the enterprise take up been? It's interesting that you're going in that direction.
Yeah. As far as the application libraries, the APIs, I mean, you'll find Qt used in thing. I mean, we're using Skype right now. That's written with Qt.
Oh, is it? I didn't know that.
If you've used Google Earth, little application you may have heard of, that uses Qt. So Adobe uses it in their photo book application. So you'll see a lot of these applications. We have huge amounts of market share in GIS, imaging, and EDS, electronic design systems. So the adoption of Qt has always been pretty good. What's kept the adoption of KDE as an application development platform down is that we weren't until very recently cross-platform. So now people are starting to use, say, Phonon, which is, you know, one of the KDE libraries that also comes with Qt now. And so we're starting to see greater uptake and greater interest in, you know, things like WebKit and Phonon and Solid and various of our libraries. For our applications, it depends on where in the world you are. So it's, you know, like a lot of, you know, or pretty much any disruptive technology, it rarely emerges uniformly across a market. So if you go to, say, Brazil, you will see us, say, in all the public classrooms. Same thing if you go to the, you know, the Gran Canarias. If you go to Europe, you'll see us in a lot of government offices. It so happens that our legal office, our lawyers in Frankfurt that work with us with our nonprofit foundation just coincidentally happened to use KDE on their desktop. We didn't know that when they hired them, but it worked out. So depending on where you go in the world, you'll see more or less adoption of it. We're starting to see an uptick in educational deployments in North America. But to be, you know, frank and honest, North America is probably our, you know, and for Linux on the desktop in general, the weakest market in the world right now. And there's a number of reasons for that. But outside of North America, we're seeing really good adoption, especially in emerging markets in Asia and South America, and government and education in Europe. So that's where the enterprise adoption is going. And now that we can run on Windows as well, we have, you know, with like with Contact, that's a really interesting story because that is allowing some of the European governments to choose one interface that they know the security of for their, because, I mean, let's face it, you're doing your email, right? How much of the government information these days, you know, coordination goes over email and shared calendaring, a scary amount of it. So for them, they get this application that has all the security features they want, that they can audit as they wish, and they can actually pay people and go, hey, we want this specific security feature in there, which is where all the GPG support, for instance, the cryptography support in Contact has come from. And so they're able to do this, and at the same time, they get the flexibility to choose whether or not they actually want to use, you know, a Microsoft Exchange server, or if they'd rather go with something such as the open source Colab server. So it gives them options and choice. So we're seeing some really nice uptick in interest in the enterprise now that we have some of these cross-platform solutions as well.
It's very exciting. I'm kind of Amarok's coming in. It's a torrent, so it's a little slow because I'm on Comcast, you know, but it'll come in, and I think that's I can't wait to see how these run and how well they run on a Macintosh or on Windows.
Well, and this is what I think is really interesting about the whole dynamic. I mean, we talk about, you know, the application development framework. We talk about enterprise. And what has been really rewarding, you know, for me as an individual who really cares about, you know, the free software community inside of it. You know, Randall and I have run into each other once or twice at free software events here and there. Yes. You know, that's something that is really near and dear to my heart is that we've managed as a community to, you know, bring in people with, you know, they're more enterprise oriented or more development oriented. At the same time, we've been able to grow consistently over time our grassroots community. You know, people who are both, you know, just either straight out enthusiasts, they like using software because that's what they do as a hobby, which is probably confusing to a lot of people that there, you know, such people exist, but they do. And we've been able to grow this really great, vibrant community that spans users and system administrators, you know, the traditionals, but also artists. So you'll see a lot of, you know, vastly improved artwork and whatnot in KDE 4. And that's simply because we've really attracted a nice community of artists. And if you go to kde-look.org, you'll see their work, you know, just thousands upon thousands of people that have uploaded artwork, you know, for the KDE community. And we're starting to see the same thing happen when it comes to things like marketing and legal expertise and whatnot. So that's been really rewarding that we've been able to, you know, kind of balance these different worlds without having to sacrifice one or make compromises along the way.
For those of us who are now playing with KDE, whether it's on Linux or some other desktop, what are some of your favorite KDE applications? There's some new ones out that look pretty cool, like this Marble.
Yeah, Marble is really, really neat. And it's one of my favorite stories because it works with OpenStreetMap, which is an online web service that allows people to come together and make maps of the world. And if you wonder why that's required, it's because there, up until OpenStreetMap, there was no large body of non-encumbered mapping data. It was a commercial enterprise that companies jealously guarded. In fact, all the companies that made or published mapping data would put little errors in their maps so that they could tell if you copy their maps, because you will copy their errors as well. So if you buy a map book, there's no such thing as a perfectly accurate map book. In fact, they're all intentionally flawed. So OpenStreetMap was an open source approach to mapping the world. Again, one of those, you know, in retrospect, crazy ideas. Why don't we just map the world with GPS devices? And what's amazing is they've pulled it off, and the coverage is just ridiculous. So Marble is a desktop application, much like Google Earth. You get a 3D Earth with stars in the background, and you can zoom in and out and pan and, you know, bookmark sites and put your, if you have a GPS, you can put your GPS traces on it, and you can measure distances. But it also works with OSM or OpenStreetMap, so you can actually zoom right in and look at the street level maps. They've been working for 4.2 on integrated search, so you can just type in an address and it will take you to that, you know, street level map anywhere in the world, tapping into OSM. It's a really great application. It doesn't use OpenGL, so it runs on pretty much anything that you throw at it without, you know, having to have a really impressive video card or anything like that. And it works quite well. Some of the other applications that I think are really promising, I'm always blown away by the educational applications that we have. We have applications that do things like chemistry teaching, which started as a high school teaching aid for the periodic table and has become the workbench for university students that are working on master's diplomas and whatnot in actual subatomic chemistry and whatnot. So it's really growing there. We've got, I think, over 20 applications now that cover various educational topics, ranging from language to math to science and test taking and flashcards and all kinds of things. The games are also kind of cool, too. I mean, they're simple games. They're little desktop games ranging from, you know, card games to little online strategy games and whatnot. But they're really pretty. They look really nice. In fact, they use what's called SVG, or scalable vector graphics, which is an open document or an open format for describing images that will actually grow and shrink depending on the resolution of the screen or how big you make them. So you have these applications that shrink down to the size of a cell phone screen, or you can play them equally right on your laptop. So we've got, you know, a few dozen games that we ship now with KDE 4. Those are really cool. Some of the other applications that I'm really excited about, obviously I hack on Plasma in the workspace, and I think some of the things that we're doing there is really interesting as far as some of the service-oriented things we're going to be bringing out in 4.2. KOffice, very cool. Krita, I think, is one of the few open-source imaging applications that actually does true full color, so you get, you know, 16 or better bits per channel.
How do you spell it?
Krita, K-R-I-T-A.
R-I-T-A, okay.
I believe it's a Dutch painter, like some guy who's now long dead, I believe. But yeah, you can also use it with, you know, Wacom tablets and pressure-sensitive tablets. And they actually, it was the first production software anywhere, open or closed, that actually did physically realistic color blending. It actually does a light simulation internally. So when you mix the paints together, if you're doing the if you're using the natural media features of it, you mix two colors together and actually does proper color blending, just like you would see in the real world. This is stuff they took right out of academic research, and we happen to be the first to actually market with it, which is kind of neat and cool. So if you're an artist that has one of those tablets, Krita is definitely one to watch. Other than that, we've talked about Amarok quite a bit. I'm a huge fan
of
what they're doing. The actual workspace itself comes with a lot of really great stuff, such as Dolphin, the file manager, which allows you to tag and rate and annotate files. And this all gets stored in something called, bizarrely enough, Nepomuk, which is a what they call a social semantic desktop. And what we're working towards there is the ability to take any piece of information on your desktop, be it an email or a calendar event or a file or a URL or a note you take, and be able to both relate it either explicitly or have the system guide you towards relating it to other other items. And basically build a social network of your data, or based on your data, directly inside of your device, your laptop, or what have you. Again, another thing that we're leading edge on, taking research right out of academia, is actually funded by the European Union, this research. So we're working towards that, so that you can actually do things such as in 4.2, name your different contexts on your desktop. So you can say, I'm doing work, I'm doing my podcast show. And when you switch that, it actually sends a signal to other applications via the Nepomuk framework that allows them to contextually shift what they're showing and what they're displaying. So you can change the the tools you have on your desktop. We have a very sophisticated widget system, so you can have different RSS feeds, calculators, mini web browsers, little mini games, all kinds of widgets and wadgets on your desktop. And when you change the context that you're working within, you can actually have different sets of widgets come and go depending on your context. And the widgets themselves can decide what to show depending on the context. So this is a new set of technology that we've really brought in with KDE 4.2. And that's going to be one of the things that over 4.3, 4.4, the next year or two, we're really going to start to see the maturation of that side of it. So that's kind of one of the exciting things that's in progress right now. And you'll see in the coming couple of releases become more visible to the user. So we've got a bunch of really cool stuff right now, but the future is still bright and wide open. We've got a lot of stuff to bring to the table still.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
Aaron, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Definitely.
Well, I really appreciate you having me on. If any of your listeners are interested, please join us. We've got forums at forum.kde.org, where you can go and talk and ask questions and what have you. If you're a developer, visit TechBase, T-E-C-H-B-A-S-E, techbase.kde.org. It's full of developer information. And if you're a user, we also have UserBase now. So there's some really good places to get your feet wet, whether you're a user or a developer. And once again, thanks for having me on.
Aaron Sago of the K Desktop, KDE.org. Thank you, Aaron. Take care. I'm getting excited now. I mean, I've always liked the K Desktop. I didn't say this to Aaron. I probably wouldn't want to say it to his face. But one of the reasons I think it's very popular is because it feels like Windows. It's used a lot on Linux distributions where they feel like, feel like you're going to be moving from Windows, and you'll feel comfortable with this. But it's so powerful now that I think that it's gone well beyond that initial feeling I had about it.
Great.
And
great,
I love it that I had no idea I could run it on Mac and Windows.
That's just great. I mean, and actually, when I bumped into Aaron, I think in Venezuela last year, and I know there was some tequila involved there. I just didn't want to go into the whole story. But there's some... I remember one of the things he was talking about was just that he told me about the Google Earth and how it had been portable across all the platforms because it's written in Qt. And
yeah,
it's very nice that now. Dude. It's funny, too, because like last week's show and this week's show are both about cross-platform libraries.
That's the future. Nobody wants to spend all that energy writing a program that only runs on one operating system. And that's why, people are always saying, oh, but don't you like VB, .NET VB? Don't you like that? No. Yeah, it's a great development environment, but it's a dead end because it runs on Windows only.
That's right. Same thing with .NET. I mean, Mono, of course, has brought out the possibility of running .NET stuff in other places. So,
well, that's true. That's true.
It's getting a little bit
and
more
you,
like
And
that.
You can say the same thing about Xcode. Except that Xcode does use GCC, so at least, once you kind of start getting used to it, you can move to other platforms that'll give you cross-platform. I always liked Qt. I always thought it was a very clean library, very easy to understand, very easy to use. It's kind of my favorite library.
Out of all the libraries you've collected over the years.
I collect them. I do. I don't write anything. But if I ever have to, I'm ready.
From 2 to 4 a.m. when you're actually writing stuff.
Well, it's like collecting fountain pens. I don't use them either because they leak all over my pocket. But I love them.
Well, it's like I go to conferences all the time, and I collect conference T-shirts and conference swag bags.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're just in this big stack at home.
You don't need any more of those.
Oh gosh, I know it. And I used to go through the expo center, whatever it is, you know, the place where the vendors are showing off stuff. And I used to try to get there like early and try to get all the cool stuff. And then I'd bring it home, or I'd have to, you know, haul it home on the plane. And then it would just end up in these stacks at home. Right, I can't tell you how many logo pins I have, or mugs even. I've got mugs coming out of my ears here. Actually, you know, I haven't bought any like silverware or like dishware, because if you go to my kitchen, which I occasionally walk through on my way out to my car, I don't really know what
the only time
for.
You visit. Yeah,
yeah. If you open up the cupboard, though, you'll see there's no two mugs that are alike.
Oh,
it's every single mug came from some conference or
Randall lives on gimme furniture. If they would give you a bed, he'd use it.
Right. So all my T-shirts are all, you know, I haven't bought a T-shirt ever. Well, except for other people, I bought a lot of T-shirts. But
yeah, you know, I don't need to buy T-shirts exactly because people just throw them at me all the time.
Yeah. I mean, I hardly ever wear T-shirts anymore anyway. I generally have got stuff with buttons now.
Men of our age and girth should not wear T-shirts.
My girth is getting less every day, though.
Mine too. We're going to have a girth off.
Oh, boy, I tell you. You know, we'll compare pictures on camera next week. So
girth off.
Good.
Girth off. So somebody asked in the chat room, I thought this was a good question, since we are an open source show. We always assume that anybody listening is into open source and gets it. But this is a question I think a lot of people who don't, you know, really deal with the open source community a lot ask themselves. And I'm glad NetGuy asked it. He says, I'm still confused about open source. Mm-hmm. Is it safe even though people can see how it all works? Can't bad guys take advantage of applications that are open?
Well, the bad guys are going to see it either way because they're going to reverse engineer it. They're going to decompile it. So if it was the case that open source was more dangerous, we wouldn't have any Windows viruses, you know.
So the difference is with an open source, it's commented. You can see the comments. You can see the variable names. You might understand it a little more quickly. Bad guys have the incentive, though, to figure out anything, and you can disassemble anything and figure out what it's doing. I'm sure that's one of the ways they attack it is they disassemble it.
Yeah, so I think for the fact that it's open source and there's a lot more pairs of eyes on it, there's an effect on both ends of that. One is that as an application programmer writing open source software, I want to be better because other people are going to see it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to pay attention to the literature about Stack Overflows and things like that.
You don't want to be embarrassed.
You want to be embarrassed. That's right. But on the other side of that, as somebody receiving open source code, because I can go through it easily without having to decompile it, as a good guy, I can go through and make sure that, you know, the author didn't do something stupid.
It's a net gain. I mean, yeah, it's easier to look at it, but it's also more people looking at it, more people vetting it. I'll give you a really good example. I really strongly encourage people who want to use encryption utilities to use open source encryption utilities. It's the only way you could be sure there's no back door so that the government or NSA can listen in.
Which is why we use Skype for this.
Which, and by the way, we now know that governments do listen in on Skype, or at least they watch the chats. So, yeah, I mean, we're not using Skype. This is not a conversation that I'm trying to hide from the U.S. government.
But, quite the opposite. We're publishing it in 2 days.
Yeah, they can listen anytime they want. They don't even need to listen to Skype. They could just watch live or listen at twit.am or watch twit.tv. But if I'm going to use a scrambler on my email or on my disks, I'm going to use TrueCrypt because it's open source. That means two things. Experts have looked at the algorithms and they know they work, and there's no backdoor. So I'm a big believer in transparency, and I think open software, frankly, is the future. In fact, I think all software really wants to be open. This whole idea of closed source proprietary software is an aberration that was created not in the earliest days, but in some of the early days of computing And I think it's going away, to be honest with you.
Well, you know, I disagree with your use of anthropomorphizing software, but okay. Software doesn't want anything. Software just sits there.
It just sits there.
You want all the software.
Well,
to be open, right?
But you know, hackers have the one of the hacker rules is information wants to be free. You're right. Of course, information doesn't want to be free, but like water, it flows. And I think software, there's a natural flow towards openness. And I mean,
I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just.
I know, and you're right. I shouldn't anthropomorphize it. It doesn't want anything. But
data wants to be anthropomorphized.
That's good. I want a T-shirt that says that.
I saw that on a SIG somewhere. It was pretty.
I love that. That's pretty good. I think that that's just that. It's kind of a natural state of being, and you know, as we move towards web apps, in a way, it's where it's headed because a lot of these apps are written in HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, and unless you intentionally obfuscate it, they're by nature open.
Well, and you can't have like an open protocol, from the web client to the web server without having some open source involved, right. Really, because you know you're going to eventually see the protocol anyway. It's like when we were talking to the guys at the Yahoo User Interface Library, and they said, well, they're going to see the JavaScript anyway. We might as well make it open source. And I thought that was, you know, practical, but, you know, it's a nice thing. You could also say it as a stand, but it was nice that it was, you know, just recognizing the practicality of it is that once you're transmitting stuff across the wire, it's going to be seen. It's going to be used.
What about this model? I mean, and object-oriented languages make this very doable. It's okay to have a black box or two, but the protocols have to be open the way, otherwise they can't communicate.
I am a hardliner on open standards for data storage, for transmission, because I believe that level of interoperation where I can create anything that reads my spreadsheet created with some other vendor's language is really handy. This whole idea of having locked up, especially if we're talking, taxpayer dollars being spent on documents that have to have legacy value, that can't be in a proprietary format at all. And so if, you know, you guys listening at home, if you've got a chance to, talk to your legislators and make sure that they start writing, you know, open source requirements for government documents. That's an easy first step to make.
Yeah.
And it's something that almost everybody, it's hard not to get behind that. So
object-oriented programming really kind of requires this kind of open message handling, open communication between objects. And I think that's really where everything is moving. There's a Squeak book that you can get print on demand from Lulu.
Yeah, good one.
That I ordered. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. You know,
Squeak by Example.
Squeak by Example. That's the one.
Great book.
Now, I actually want to bring this up with you. You're on the Squeak board.
In fact, I met earlier today with them. Yeah, I have a biweekly meeting, so it's just before this call. In fact, so
when you go, I've got Squeak running, and I love it. And you know, I've played with it before and so forth. But I went to learn. The small talk language, and they have a few links. The very first link, the one that they recommend, is a tutorial. Actually, I guess it's in the documentation section. That walks you through step by step to design a game. It's very cool. The laser game tutorial.
Yeah, the laser game. It's a great tutorial. Yeah.
Maybe I'm stupid, Randall, but I get right up to a point where, he doesn't. I wish he did a little more explanation about why he's doing what he's doing. It's kind of a step-by-step thing. But I get right up to a point. Let me see if I can find the point in the tutorial.
I think that the problem is that there is a couple of tutorials out there that are written presuming you're using one of Damien's dev images instead of the original image.
I don't think that's it. It's a, so what happens is he says, and now create a method, and he doesn't tell me how.
Yeah.
And he's got an illustration of it, and I'm just stopped. I am absolutely literally stuck in the tutorial. I'll send you the page number, and maybe you can just explain to me, because I want to do this, and I'm walking through it, and I'm really enjoying it, and it's really cool.
Leo, if you had another half hour to an hour to record shows every week, we could just run through the entire Squeak tutorial live.
Like to do that. You want to do that sometime? It doesn't have to be something we put out as a recording, but we could just do it.
Yeah. Okay. Whatever you want to do. That sounds good. Like I said, just finding time in your busy schedule and my busy schedule to coordinate even more. So.
Well, he's got. You know what I like about this is he really focuses on doing test units before you get too far down the road.
That's an essential thing that came out of the whole small talk community that started.
I love that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And of course, now every language has that capability. Mm-hmm. He left me behind. Let me see if I can find the page because, well, I should do that. But let's figure out a time to do that. That would be so much fun.
We should probably just wrap up this show before we keep talking the rest of the night.
I love that. The idea of, and that's one of the things we did Twit Live for, is that there are stuff that you wouldn't do on a weekly basis, but you might want to do once in a while. And I think going through this tutorial step by step. And so we'll plan this. We'll put it on the schedule. We'll tell you. And and then you can come to us, watch it live. We'll rebroadcast it too at live.twit.tv. But preparatory to doing that, you should all go to squeak.org and download the current Squeak and start playing with it and get comfortable with it.
Yeah, we're actually going to have a new release, I think, by the end of the year that completely, finally cleans up the licensing issue. We've been working on that for a couple of years.
Really? What's the licensing issue?
Well, you know, the original code was released by Apple under kind of a weird Apple open source license that required some sort of, you know, holding Apple harmless and a bunch of other weird things. And so Squeak from the beginning up to there, up to like a couple of years ago, I think it is, everything you contributed to Squeak had to be under this Apple license. Apple public source license or whatever. But they realized that that was too restrictive. So they said, well, we want to relicense it. So they went back to Apple and they said, okay, we would like you to just adopt the MIT license or something equivalent to it, something real broad, real BSD style, MIT style, real broad. And Apple said, sure, that's fine. But the problem is that everybody who had contributed to it since Apple released it also had to agree.
Which is
so
quite
we've
a few
had
people.
Something to around the order of 300 or 400 legal signed documents to collect. And so that's been going on for the last 2 years. I mean, this affects the OLPC. It affects VPRI, the company that's producing Open Croquet. It affects a lot of companies that need to have this license absolutely spotless. So the board of the Squeak director board, of which I'm a member of now, and everybody else has all been working really hard to, and we've even had, I mean, I don't want to be too morbid about this, but one of the contributors died.
So you got to get his estate to sign this.
The estate actually finally signed the piece of paper, but they couldn't understand what the value of their contributions were, so they didn't know whether they should hold out for $1 million or just sign over. I mean, if
it's
I'm pretty sure the guy.
Stuff. Yeah. This is why licensing. This is why we spend so much time talking about licenses,
right?
And why it's so important. Why we had Eben Moglen on a few episodes, many episodes ago, talking about GPL3. This stuff is very important.
Yeah,
you can't go forward without it.
And so Squeak 4.0 will be out by the end of the year, and it will be license clean. It will be absolutely every piece of code, and it will be under the MIT-style license. I think it's the Apache license or something, but whatever the license is that Squeak uses, which is a BSD-style license, which means you can take Squeak and build whatever you want to on top of it and use it in any way that you want, and it just works. So it's a big accomplishment. So we're definitely been working hard to try to keep pushing this forward.
You and I are going to do an impromptu Squeak show sometime, so I can learn more Squeak.
We're going to have to. Can I tell you what's coming up?
Yeah, Randall, what do you got booked ahead for us?
Well, again, if you go to twit.tv/floss, you'll see the upcoming spreadsheet. A couple changes I made just in the last couple days.
Okay.
We have Peter St. Andre from Jabber is coming on December 3rd.
I've been wanting to talk to him.
Well, he actually was, you know, again, people are watching the spreadsheet. Somebody who knew him contacted him. He wrote me and said, my name's on some spreadsheet. Like, you want to talk to me or something? I said, yeah.
I've been dying to talk to him. I'm following him on Didenica. But he has a spec for open micro blogging based on Jabber that I'm very interested in because I want to get the ball rolling on this thing.
Yeah, so we're talking to him on December 3rd. I also have a couple of people on the MIFOS project, which is the micro financial system. It's helping third world countries get better with finances and stuff. Very timely show, actually.
Okay.
So
that's
got them coming up on November 19th. So and then next week we're doing the barbecue, and
we'll do that live. We're going to put the cameras if it's not rainy and the weather's been beautiful in Petaluma. It's like 80 degrees. It's beautiful right now.
Should be great. So October 22nd, we're meeting with the people. Well, you and I are meeting in studio, and we're chatting with the people from the Southern California Linux Expo. So
excellent.
We're going to talk more about Linux.
And then we'll all have charred meat with Captain Neil of Insight Cruises.
Yep. And on the short list, we've got a lot of other really good shows just sort of lining themselves up. But I won't bother you until we get booking on those. But again, you go to the spreadsheet. Find out what's going on. I've been getting, must be 15, 20 pieces of email a day with people saying, oh, here's the email address for this person. It's just been wonderful. Thanks, guys, that's for doing that. I now have, if you look in the spreadsheet, if you look at waiting to contact, that's a year's worth of shows already.
So, holy cow. You better, wow, maybe we better double up and start doing this twice a week. Floss semi-weekly.
Plus hourly.
Randall, I'm going to let you go. Make sure you check out Randall at Stonehenge.com. And don't forget the Geek, I'm sorry, the Insight Cruises News. That's his podcast at InsightCruises.com. You can hear all about cruising. Soon you're going to be off on your trip. MacMania 8 is coming up in a minute. Jealous as heck. But I'll be on MacMania 9 with Randall and some really great people, including Andy Iannocco. And find out more about that at InsightCruises.com.
And we'll have Neil in studio because we're coming up next week. Remember,
we'll give Neil an hour to plug all the cruises and talk about it. Absolutely. Randall, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on Floss Weekly.